Iran warns against the establishment of any regional coalition with Israel, saying such a coalition will jeopardize West Asia's security and stability. Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps arrests several foreign nationals, including Britain's deputy ambassador in Tehran, for acts of spying. Russia says its troops have destroyed two advanced US-made HIMARS rocket systems in eastern Ukraine. Kiev rejects Moscow's claim as fake. That's also in the headlines. Thank you for joining us. Our top story this hour: the Secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council has raised the alarm about the consequences of forming any coalition with the Israeli regime. Ali Shamkhani was speaking in a meeting with the visiting Qatari Foreign Minister Mohammed bin Abdulrahman Al Thani in Tehran. The Iranian top security official said any coalition with Tel Aviv will jeopardize West Asia's security and stability. He labeled terrorism and Zionism the main components of insecurity in the region. Shamkhani also touched upon Iran's regional strategy. He said Tehran has always sought to help preserve the territorial integrity of all countries and expand ties with its neighbors on the basis of good neighborliness. The Qatari foreign minister, for his part, called for establishing lasting peace in the region. Iran's foreign minister says Tehran is determined to reach a good, strong and lasting agreement on the revival of the 2015 deal. Hossein Amir Abdullahian said such an agreement must guarantee the interests of the Islamic Republic. He made the comments in a press briefing with his Qatari counterpart, Mohammed bin Abdulrahman Al Thani, in Tehran. Amir Abdullahian also touched upon recent indirect talks between Iran and the United States in the Qatari capital over the revival of the JCPOA. He rejected U.S. claims that Iran raised demands outside the JCPOA framework.
Despite some media claims from the American side, we have no excessive demands. We have no demands outside of the JCPOA framework. Our demands are completely within the bounds of the 2015 agreement.
The top diplomat said that in last week's Doha talks, Tehran made it clear that the U.S. must provide an effective guarantee that Iran will be able to reap full economic benefits of a revived deal. The Doha negotiations were held as an extension of previous talks held in the Austrian capital. Now, the Vienna talks that began in April 2021 were stalled in March this year over what Tehran called Washington's excessive demands. The JCPOA was left in tatters after Washington unilaterally withdrew from it in 2018 and reinstated sanctions against the Islamic Republic. Iran remains adamant that the restoration of the deal hinges on the verifiable removal of the U.S. sanctions. Political analyst Sayed Mostafa Khoshchashm says the United States has not presented any initiative that would break the stalemate in the JCPOA revival talks.
Since the talks started months ago, Iran has been the only party to bring up new initiatives and plans and offers. Whenever there was, stalemate or the talks were pushed into a deadlock, in order to help actually the talks move forward. And this has been the case even some 6 weeks ago. Iran offered a new initiative in order to help drive the talks out of the deadlock, but Americans have always been very much reluctant to, bringing new initiatives or, offering or putting different offers on the table. And on the contrary, they have been adamant, and then they have sometimes shown buyer's remorse, like in midwinter, when everyone thought that we were about to wrap up the deal. Suddenly, they showed buyer's remorse over three different points regarding guarantees and sanctions. But it's pretty much clear that Americans are just looking for a deal in name, not in content. This was the case, actually, in Doha.
Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says it has arrested several foreign nationals, including Britain's deputy ambassador in Tehran, for acts of spying. The IRGC's intelligence organization says the detainees were connected to a number of foreign embassies in Iran and were engaged in activities unrelated to their diplomatic missions. It says the detainees were collecting soil samples in restricted areas in different parts of the country. The IRGC also released a footage showing the arrested foreigners in the process of collecting soil samples. Among those arrested was Giles Whittaker, Britain's deputy head of mission in Iran. According to the IRGC, he was collecting soil samples at an area in Iran's central desert when the IRGC's aerospace division was conducting a missile exercise. Russia says its troops have destroyed two advanced US-made HIMARS rocket systems and their ammunition depots in eastern Ukraine. The Russian Defense Ministry said the operation destroyed two launchers for HIMARS rockets that the US and its allies had supplied to Kiev. Ukraine's general staff has rejected Moscow's claims as fake, saying it is using the rocket system to hit Russian forces' positions. The U.S. has so far delivered four units of the rocket system to Ukraine. Washington has pledged to deliver a total of eight rocket systems to Kiev by the middle of this month, and that's despite warnings from Russia that Western weapons supply to Ukraine will only fan the flames of the war. Our correspondent Johnny Miller joined us from the city of Donetsk in eastern Ukraine to give us an update on the situation there.
Well, the beginning of this war started four months ago. It was quite hard to predict what was going to happen. Russia invaded from the north, from the south, from the west, from the east. But now, in recent weeks, it's been quite easy to predict where the next battles will be. So even last week, I spoke to you and saying where the next battle will be in Slavyansk. That's where it is starting now, because Russia is... It's a very clear battle plan at the moment, simply trying to sweep through and take the rest of Donbass. They've taken Lysychansk, and now the Ukrainians, as expected, are setting up defensive positions in Slavyansk and Kramatorsk. These are the last two kind of major settlements in the Donbass region. And of course, it's much easier for Ukraine to defend cities than it is the open ground. Russia's overwhelming artillery, air superiority, so that's where they're going to make their next defense. Frankly, it looks likely that Russia will take those cities. It seems only a matter of time. They've been destroying much of the Ukrainian army in recent weeks. So if Ukraine wasn't able to hold on to Lysychansk, it's unlikely they're going to be able to hold on to Kramatorsk and Slavyansk. But NATO, of course, is trying their best to help them defend those towns. But it's still going to be a fierce fight.
Will the British Prime Minister cling on to power? Boris Johnson himself has been called to mounting calls to resign so far, while more than 30 members of his government have resigned in under 24 hours.
It's exactly when times are tough and when the country faces pressures on the economy and pressures on their budgets, Mr. Speaker, and when we have the biggest war in Europe for 80 years, Mr. Speaker, that is exactly the moment that you'd expect a government to continue with its work, not to walk away, Mr. Speaker, and to get on with our job and to focus on the things that matter to the people of this country.
Johnson was speaking during the weekly question time debate in Parliament. He said he would only resign if he feels it's impossible for the government to go ahead. Johnson has been urged by a senior cabinet minister to resign. The community secretary, Michael Gove, says he has told the prime minister that he must go. In addition, the leader of the opposition party has also made a blistering attack on Johnson during the parliament question time.
Anyone quitting now, after defending all that, hasn't got a shred of integrity. Mr. Speaker, isn't this the first recorded case of the sinking ships fleeing the rat?
Starmer said the government is showing signs of collapse given the wave of scandals and resignations which started on Tuesday. The finance minister and health secretary have already quit. The duo said they could no longer tolerate the culture of scandal surrounding Johnson's tenure. The resignations came after it was revealed that Johnson had been aware of allegations of sexual misconduct by a member of parliament before hiring him as the ruling party's deputy chief whip.
What was meant to be a routine weekly gathering of cabinet ministers morphed into something very different. Double mortal blows to the Prime Minister Boris Johnson as his health secretary Sajid Javid and Chancellor Rishi Sunak quit their jobs within minutes of each other, handing in resignation letters that make for extraordinary reading. The vote of confidence last month, Sajid Javid wrote, was a moment for humility, grip, and new direction. I regret to say, however, that it is clear to me that the situation will not change under your leadership, and you have therefore lost my confidence too. The Chancellor also took aim at the PM's character. The public, he wrote, rightly expect government to be conducted properly, competently, and seriously.
Nothing's worse for a party than a loss of faith in the character of their leader. And these senior politicians, and let's recognise over a dozen of them have now resigned, are saying it's either Boris Johnson or us. Since Boris Johnson isn't going, they are. They're going to have to sit it out, like Boris, but there can only be one winner, and it won't be the Prime Minister.
Boris Johnson's is a government embroiled in sleaze and scandal for months, from lockdown rules-breaching parties under his roof to porn-watching MP. The latest controversy emerged over this man, Chris Pincher, forced to resign from government over accusations of sexual harassment. But the last straw was when it turned out that despite Number 10's denials, the Prime Minister knew of a past formal complaint against Pincher all along. He appointed him to his cabinet.
I apologise for it. I think in hindsight it was the wrong thing to do. I apologise to everybody who's been badly affected by it.
But that didn't wash with the now former Chancellor and Health Secretary or the dozens of MPs who have already resigned. More defections could be on the way.
There's no doubt that we will see more resignations, with quite a few cabinet ministers not declaring one way or the other. But the realpolitik here is he's lost the confidence of his party. He's lost the confidence of a very large number of people whom he himself appointed, and the public aren't taking him seriously. I like Boris as a friend. I think he's a decent man. But the one thing he doesn't seem to have is good judgment about when to leave.
Whether or not Boris Johnson can survive politically is a question debated by his friends and foes for months. The question now is whether these recent resignations will be the beginning of the end for a prime minister whose leadership is in freefall and as the specter of a new no-confidence vote looms large. Saeed Pour is up, London.
Staying in Europe, Italy's taxi drivers have staged a nationwide strike against the government's competition bill. They say the sector deregulation introduced by the bill would open them up to unfair competition from private hired services. Max Gividi reports from Rome.
Taxi drivers have staged a nationwide strike against the government's plan to deregulate the sector. The industrial action was called by a string of unions representing cab drivers in opposition to Article 10 of a competition bill linked to the reforms the EU requires in exchange for the funding of Italy's post-COVID National Recovery and Resilience Fund. Unionists say that the regulation will open cab drivers up to unfair competition from web-based ride-sharing services.
A law that regulates our sector was already approved 3 years ago, and the EU doesn't require further amendments. Taxi fares are presently regulated by local authorities. Prices would go ballistic if we let the privates take over. A deregulation would favour multinationals over independent drivers. Full stop.
On Monday, a protest called by unionists in Rome's central quarters led to disruption to traffic and buses in the Italian capital. The demonstration ended up in clashes with police. On Tuesday, tens of cab drivers gathered at Rome's municipality, asking local authorities to take their side. Protests were also held in Milan and other Italian cities.
Like taxi drivers across the European Union, Italy's licensed cabbies have been protesting ever since private hired services such as Uber arrived on the scene in 2014. An endless series of strikes and protests against the liberalization of the sector have been staged over the years.
This government works for the almighty dollar, that's it. We are in the midst of an unprecedented economic crisis. And what does the executive do? It gives multinationals more privileges. What about us, the people?
Tension within the broad coalition supporting Prime Minister Mario Draghi's government was high over the competition bill until not long ago. However, a split in the once anti-establishment five-star movement, with Foreign Minister Luigi Di Maio embracing Draghi's more pro-market views, seems to have calmed down the churning waters of Italian politics. Max Civili, Rome.
Turning elsewhere, Uzbekistan's president has blamed, quote, foreign forces for inciting unrest in the country's autonomous Qoraqalpakistan Republic. President Shavkat Mirziyoyev said the main goal of the unrest was to attack the territorial integrity of Uzbekistan and create an inter-ethnic conflict. He said the new developments in his country were planned for years by foreign forces. Mirziyoyev, that is, however, gave no evidence of foreign involvement and did not name any country specifically. The protests broke out last week in response to government plans to revoke Qoraqalpakistan's autonomous status. Mirziyoyev quickly abandoned the proposal when the demonstrations broke out. Authorities say 14 civilians and four law enforcement officers have died in days of unrest. Uzbekistan's foreign ministry says 107 law enforcement officers have been seriously injured during the unrest, of whom 23 are in critical condition. That brings an end to World Bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The limelight.
The latest report from Brazil's National Institute for Space Research showed that the Brazilian Amazon has lost 1,450 square miles of jungle since the start of 2022. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Jake Johnson, journalist. This article is published under the heading Activist Fear, Tipping Point of No Return as Fires in Amazon Rainforest Surge. Stay tuned for more. The Brazilian government has published a report showing that more than 2,500 fire hotspots were recorded in the Amazon rainforest last month, the highest number for June since 2007, one of the worst years ever for the critical ecosystem. The latest report from Brazil's National Institute for Space Research showed that the Brazilian Amazon has lost 1,450 square miles of jungle since the start of 2022. Greenpeace Brazil said in response to the alarming figures that the far-right Bolsonaro government's systematic rampage against basic environmental protections is responsible for the surge in rainforest fires and overall deforestation, which have helped transform parts of the Amazon, long known as a key carbon sink, into sources of planet-warming greenhouse gas. agribusiness is hitting new records for forest destruction as the dry season arrives in the Amazon, said Christian Mazzetti, spokesperson for Greenpeace Brazil, adding, illegal burnings and deforestation have accelerated over the last 3 years as a direct result of the Brazilian government's anti-environmental agenda that encourages the destruction of the forest. Mazzetti added, if this trend does not change, we will approach the tipping point of no return, in which the Amazon could fail as a rainforest. Brazilian academics have warned in recent months that a Bolsonaro victory in the October presidential election would mean total demise for the Brazilian Amazon. Recent polling shows that Bolsonaro is trailing leftist former president Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, who has vowed to pursue net zero deforestation if elected. If Bolsonaro remains in the power of presidency, it's hopeless in terms of the environment, Marcio Astorini, executive secretary of the Sao Paulo-based Climate Observatory, told HuffPost in April, a record-shattering month of Amazon deforestation. Astorini said there will be more deforestation. The Amazon will fast forward to its collapse point. Environmental groups have voiced dismay at the Biden administration's failure to confront Bolsonaro on the international stage over his government's assault on the Amazon. The U.S. is Brazil's second-largest trading partner. Last month, during the U.S.-hosted Summit of the Americas in Los Angeles, President Biden went as far as to praise Bolsonaro for trying to protect the Amazon. In addition to being divorced from reality, Biden's statement is remarkably tone-deaf. Maria Laura Canio and Luciana Teles Chavez of Human Rights Watch wrote on the final day of the summit where the two leaders met for the first time. Biden has shamefully squandered the opportunity to leverage his meeting with Bolsonaro to support the courageous defenders of the Amazon. These defenders are putting their lives on the line to protect the world's largest rainforest and a vital bulwark against climate change. They continued. Biden should correct this mistake and press Bolsonaro to reverse his damaging policies, urging Bolsonaro to get Brazil back on track in fighting deforestation and protecting forest defenders from violence. Diana Ruiz, the head of forests at Greenpeace USA, said in a statement that, up to now, the Biden administration has only legitimized the Brazilian government's anti-indigenous and anti-environmental agenda. Ruiz added, the U.S. has a responsibility to act and stop making deals with President Bolsonaro, who continues to wage an assault against indigenous peoples and environmental defenders.
Food for thought.
Salam everybody and a happy day for all of you. Today also as food for thought, we have selected another beautiful aphorism from the master of eloquence and wisdom, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him, the first infallible successor of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Here it is. Incapability is a catastrophe, Endurance is bravery. Abstinence is riches. Self-restraint is a shield against sin. And the best companion is submission to Allah's will.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, good manner and incuriosity. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the topic of good manner and incuriosity. In the Islamic lifestyle, when we look at the Islamic text, we see that the good manner does not mean to be or having the incuriosity in the matters of the life. When we see something which is bad in the society, the good manner does not say that when you see something bad happening, when you see some kind of injustice happening in the society, be quiet and deal with it in a good way or the kindness. Rather, Islam says that if there is something which is bad, obviously we have Amar bil Ma'ruf and Nahi anil Munkar, calling towards the good and forbidding the bad deeds or forbidding the bad or evil. When we see the evil in there, the good manner is to deal with the harshness. It is not to deal with the smile. When we see an evil in the society, the good manner does not teaches us to deal with the people with kindness, to deal with the people with a smile, to see the people with a smile. For example, if there are people who purposefully, we see that in the month of Ramadan, being a Muslim, they do not fast purposefully. They break their fast in front of others. Then it is not a place to smile upon them, to give them a smile. Because when you give a smile to such a person, he gets the courage of doing that evil again and again. But if we look them harshly, if we look them in a way so that they feel guilty, they will never again repeat the same thing in the month of Ramadan. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of the good manner and incuriosity. In the Islamic teachings, we said that it is it is not the part of good manner that someone performs an evil. We should deal with the person. We should face a person with kindness, with the smile. And the example which we gave was the example when in the month of Ramadan, when there is the fasting is an obligatory upon everyone, and we see someone purposefully break his fast during the day, and with no reason he eats in front of other people who are fasting. Now there, if we smile on such a person, obviously this is something which encourages him to perform that evil again and again. Therefore, we need to see him in a way so that he feels guilty. And this is what husne khulq means. In the good manner does not mean having incuriosity. Good manner means that when there is an evil, you should stop evil. When there is a good thing, you need to smile. If you're calling someone towards the right path, yes, you need to call them with a kindness. You need to call them with a smile, with kindness. You need to talk them softly so that they come towards you because you are preaching something. But on the other hand, if there is an evil, if there is a crime happening, it does not mean to show incuriosity to that crime or to that evil. And this is what husne khulq or the good manner means in the Islamic lifestyle. So in the Islamic lifestyle, when we talk about the good manner, we need to consider all these points in our minds and then having a good manner in the society, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
News, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With delight.
Colombia's long hunt for a fabled Spanish ship, San Jose Galleon, that sank centuries ago, comes to an end. But the mission leads to two more nearby shipwrecks filled with treasures.
We have found two additional ships, one ship that is from the colonial period and another that, from the point of view of preliminary analysis, corresponds to the Republican period of our history. We also have related vessels, around a dozen similar boats, that will be located by our Navy.
The colonial-era vessels were found near Colombia's Caribbean port of Cartagena. A remotely operated vehicle reached 900 meters beneath to capture the shipwrecks and treasures inside them. San Jose Galleon sank in a deadly battle against English warships in 1708, taking with it billions in treasure. The Colombian president says the findings will be preserved and protected until extraction is done completely. The riches will then be displayed in museums.
Colombian scientists managed to reproduce an endangered species of frog, bringing it back from the brink of extinction. The scientists were able to reproduce 29 specimens of Lehman's poison frog after years of investigations and experiments using a lab built specifically for this species. They have released the frogs into the Colombian Pacific region with the hope of starting its repopulation.
We observe how the frogs adapt to this ecosystem, which is theirs, but it is a constant monitoring. And the idea is that of these first 29 frogs at the moment, there will be many more little frogs, and now we can tell the world that they are not in danger of extinction.
The scientists, however, warned that this particular species of frog is very difficult to reproduce or maintain under human care. They are also worried about the illegal trade of the frogs, which has already played a key role in pushing the rare species towards extinction. Colombia is home to over 700 frog species, more than any other country in the world except Brazil. In Brazil, a 100-year-old man has broken the world record for the longest spell working at a single company. Walter Orthman has entered the Guinness World Record books for working at the same fabric company for an astonishing period of 84 years. He started on the factory floor before moving into administration and later on into the sales management. Despite his extraordinary accomplishment, Orthman's advice for those looking for a long and fulfilling professional life is surprisingly routine.
You have to like to work. I started to work with that willingness and fighting spirit. You also have to start working on something you like to do. You can't just do any job to say that you're working. That doesn't work. You're not going to be able to stand it. You have to look for a job that you like to do. And there, you won't even feel the time passing. That's what happened with me. I started working here, and I liked it. I worked my way up from point to point until I got to the position I'm in today.
Ortman says his secret to a long life and breaking the record is having a healthy lifestyle and staying away from junk food. He says he avoids sugar and salt as much as possible and tries to keep a diet that is healthy for the mind and soul. In order to stay sharp, Orthman says he does stretches and maintains physical activity. A bridge too scary for many, but just the right place for those with a head for heights. Vietnam has opened the world's longest glass bottom bridge to the public.
The now recorded longest glass-bottom cliffside pathway, and it's spectacular, the engineering required to build that into the side of a cliff but maintain all the features of nature, the greenery, the rock, has been an amazing project, very successful, and I think it will attract a lot of tourists.
The White Dragon Suspension Bridge fittingly opened with a dragon dance. The structure is longer than the previous record holder in China and has two sections. One stretches over 630 meters between two mountains, while the other runs around a cliffside. Visitors can look straight down at the valley 150 meters below. The structure is safe and made from three layers of 40 millimeter tempered glass. With soaring fuel prices, the importance of solar-powered vehicles is on the rise. Now a Kashmiri math teacher has gone viral for creating a car powered by solar energy. The car, which is fully covered with solar panels, uses sunlight to charge its battery. The vehicle has a braking system that regenerates power to its batteries. The inventor of the car, Bilal Ahmed, says he has spent about $19,000 for his project and has not used external funds.
It was my dream to invent a solar car for the people of Kashmir. It took me 13 years to complete my dream. I'm thankful to the Almighty I succeeded in this project.
Bilal says he has built the car manually and without any automation. He hopes to put his fully automatic car into mass production to create jobs for local people.
Just like humans and animals, plants get sick too. But what do you do with an ill plant? An Indian man has found an answer to that. He has opened an emergency room only for plants in Amritsar, a city in India's Punjab state, a tax officer and his wife have set up the Pushpa Tree and Plant Hospital. In Pushpa, they have expert biologists and tree lovers on hand to provide the so-called sick patients with their essential nutrients. The clinic aims to treat any and every disease and even has an emergency vehicle on call for unhealthy trees around the city. The officer's wife says, just as we humans bleed, breathe, and need cures, plants also bleed, breathe, and need cures.
We provide approximately 32 various services for plants and trees, like if there's a nail in the tree, how to take out that nail, deep poisoning of the trees. Yes, you heard it right. There are people who poison the trees. Again, if the tree is not bearing fruits, there's an attack of mealybugs or another insects. That's also cured here. If the trees or plants are dying and you're unable to take care of them, even that problem is sorted out.
Only a month into the hospital's operation, Rohit Mehra and his team of 20 volunteers have already received more than 300 queries. The hospital is also completely free of charge.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Staff at the National Zoo of Cuba in the capital city of Havana are celebrating a new arrival of a rare baby white rhinoceros. The little calf, named Al, quickly became popular among other animals in the park after he was born. He is part of a conservation program that will add to a gene bank for future breeding. Al is the second white rhinoceros to be born in captivity in 18 years. The park is home to 8 white rhinos and 4 black ones. Zoo staff say the park has one of the largest exhibits of this mammal among zoos in Latin America. White rhinos are endangered species and their population has dwindled due to illegal poaching and environmental destruction.
Persian fallow deer is a unique but endangered species known for its sleek and spotted body. In this report, our correspondent Youssef Jalali takes us on a quick tour around one of the world's few protected shelters of Persian fallow deer in Iran's city of Sari.
We had to keep quiet and avoid making any sounds to film them, as they are shy and swift, and the slightest sound could send them sprinting and jumping away. Over 60 Persian fallow deer roam in Dashtanaz Wildlife Refuge in Iran's northern city of Sari. The endangered species is carefully protected here to be safe from predators and poachers.
The Persian fallow deer is native to Iran's Khuzestan province, but due to loss of habitat and threats posed to them by predators such as jackals and wild cats, they are endangered and need to be protected in semi-natural refuges like this one.
Persian fallow deer are mainly indigenous to open woodland areas spanning from East Mediterranean coasts to West and Southwest Iran. By 1875, they had gone extinct in all of their main habitats, except in southwest Iran. After a captive breeding program, the population has rebounded from only a handful of deer in the 1960s to over 200 individuals in Iran.
Dashtanaz Wildlife Refuge is a 55 hectares wide. It was introduced in 1962 as a shelter for the Persian fallow deer when the species was on the brink of extinction. At that time, 5 deer were captured and translocated to this refuge. Over the past 6 decades, their number have been multiplied through captive breeding.
The Persian fallow deer is a rare ruminant mammal belonging to the family Cervidae. They're physically larger than other fallow deer, and their antlers are bigger and less palmate. Their special beauty has turned this sanctuary into a hot tourist attraction,
in Iran's north.
This sanctuary is a tourist destination for visitors who would like to see the Hyrkanian forests in Iran's north and at the same time enjoy the wildlife and learn about efforts made to save the Persian fallow deer from extinction.
In 2015, the Persian fallow deer was registered in the IUCN Red List of Threatened Species. Dashtinaz authorities hope through continued captive breeding, the population of these special creatures will soon reach the desired number, and hopefully they will be reintroduced to their natural habitat in southwest Iran.
While they live far from their original habitat, these alluring creatures feel at home here, where they will be safe from the dangers lurking outside, which may lead to their extinction. So here, Persian fallow deer continue to embellish the nature and charm visitors with their beauty. Yusuf Jalali from Dashtinaz Wildlife Refuge in Sari.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. During the year after Donald Trump entered the Oval Office, threats of violence or even death against lawmakers of both parties increased more than fourfold, says Andrea Mazzarino Ryder in an article published under the heading Armed to the Teeth, America Has an Anger Problem. Stay tuned for more. Increasingly, it seems, Americans have an anger problem. All too many of Americans now have the urge to use name-calling, violent social media posts, threats, baseball bats, and guns to do what they once did with persuasion and voting. For example, during the year after Donald Trump entered the Oval Office, threats of violence or even death against lawmakers of both parties increased more than fourfold, and too often the call to violence seems to come from the top. Recently, the defendants in cases involving extremist violence have claimed that an elected leader or pundit told them to do it. In a country where a sitting president would lunge at his own security detail in rage, we guess this isn't so surprising anymore. Emotion rules the American political scene, and so many now tend to shoot from the hip without even knowing why. Increasing number of Americans, however, respond to the growing extremity of the moment by avoiding the latest headlines and civic engagement, fearful that some trauma will befall them even by witnessing the news. As a psychotherapist who works with veterans and military families, an expert often speaks with folks who have decided to limit their news intake or have stopped following the news altogether. Repeated mass shootings in places ranging from schools to houses of worship, combined with increased visibility and influence of militias at theoretically peaceful demonstrations, can be more scaring than the wounds soldiers once sustained in combat zones. According to the International Center for Not-for-Profit Law, 45 state legislatures in the U.S. have considered 230 bills that would criminalize the threat of violent leftist or black protest. And sadly enough, far-right activists are anything but a fringe minority movement as they challenge the very idea of peaceful elections and public protests that aren't theirs. To be sure, left-wing violence and combative rhetoric is a thing in this country, the United States, albeit a small one. The shooting of a Trump supporter by an Antifa protester in Portland, Oregon, during a Black Lives Matter demonstration in August 2020 is the lone example of a lethal attack by that left-wing group or other anti-fascists over the past 25 years. Of the 450 murders by political extremists during the last decade, approximately 4% of them were committed by left-wing groups and about 75% by right-wing, white supremacist, anti-government ones. So, what are Americans to do? As a start, given where the Trumpist movement and much of the Republican Party seems to be heading, Americans really need to do something, almost anything. As Michigan Secretary of State Jacqueline Benson, a Democrat, pointed out, facing the growing crisis on the right, I have seen no significant increase in support from national party leaders than what we experienced in 2018 when party vigilance was significant enough, but not nearly what was needed, unquote. A headline of an article in the satirical online newspaper The Onion caught the mood of the moment among progressives, left-wing group to disorganize for FBI agents to infiltrate. In it, a fictional FBI agent says, these people don't ever do anything violent. They don't ever do anything at all. Recently, a local Democratic candidate in Maryland knocked on doors seeking name and contact information as a possible volunteer for his campaign. It turned out, however, he wasn't even carrying a pen or paper. Ironically, one government institution that has at least made a nod toward countering right-wing violence is the U.S. military. Since the January 6 attacks, the Department of Defense under Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin has acknowledged an increase in domestic extremist violence carried out by active duty or reserve service members. In response, he initiated a multi-pronged strategy to screen new recruits, educate military personnel about extremism, and begin investigating extremist activity within the ranks. As partisan rhetoric heats up in the United States, progressives are guilty of focusing too hard on the most politicized identity issues, however valuable or even whatever. Asini behavior ignites behaviors and airwaves at a given moment, be it Trump's QAnon-style conspiracy mongering or ex-New York Governor Andrew Cuomo's groping. The problem is that as the Trumpists ramp up their anger, if progressives don't find a unifying message of community and love and find it soon, the guns already out there may be put to use in unspeakable ways. Progressives would do well to step back and think about the genuine big tent issues, like how to show everyone from white suburban women to rural farmers to black single parents that they have so much to lose in life if Americans don't have a government willing to continue regulating healthcare and doing so in a far better fashion. They would gain so much if, in this all too angry country of Americans, they could focus their attention on the importance of childcare for every family who needs it. Above all, if they could focus in an intense way on the ever more dangerous world they're living in, that would be a positive. Whether or not they agree on what's causing global warming, it's hard not to agree right now that they're living in an ever hotter, ever more drought-stricken, ever more extreme America. Why can't agree that it's already damn hot and the summer's just beginning?
Ukraine and Western governments.
Part 2.
There is absolutely no doubt that snipers are working here. I've counted 10 bodies.
Now on the brink of a civil war, at least 70 dead so far, and the death toll rising.
What we saw here today was a revolution.
We've invested over $5 billion to assist Ukraine in these and other goals.
NATO has expanded into 13 countries, up to the borders of Russia. 13 countries.
The focus has to be on not allowing this crisis to turn into hot war between Ukraine and Russia.
Ukraine. It's an ancient and proud land with a rich history filled with much beauty, heroism, and sacrifice. Ukraine is a borderland, a place where east meets west. This is the flag of Ukraine. The blue represents the sky. The gold, its seemingly endless fields of wheat. Ukraine is a prize many have sought, and much blood has spilled in the quest to possess it. Ukraine has been the pathway for Western powers as they attempted to conquer the East. Another historical document that changed the fate of Ukraine was the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact of 1939, one of many such agreements being signed between European countries and rising Germany. Attempting to protect his nation from the approaching Nazi threat, Joseph Stalin negotiated a treaty of non-aggression with Adolf Hitler. While promising each other peace, the Soviet and German foreign ministers Molotov and Ribbentrop realigned the map of Eastern Europe, splitting it into German and Soviet spheres of influence. In January 1943, USSR troops started pushing the Nazis back, liberating one part of Ukraine after another. Western Ukraine was the last Ukrainian region held by the Germans, finally being liberated in October of 1944. The era of political and military tension between the US and the USSR lasted for nearly 45 years, keeping humanity under the constant threat of nuclear war. In this battle, the United States never lost sight of Ukraine's importance. U.S. intelligence kept a close eye on Ukrainian